I always feel the pressure to find the perfect gift for my relatives. In this case, whether you're sending an unforgettable gift or treating yourself to everyday perfection, Omaha Steaks delivers the world's best steak experience. For me, I'm not just into steaks. I like all types of meat. That's why I'll usually get the Winter's Bestseller Pack. It comes with juicy fillets, chicken breast, pork chops, and even burgers. Omaha Steaks offers unrivaled quality and variety, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. A family-owned company with over 100 years of experience in the meat industry. Save big on unforgettable gifts with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide and earn an extra 20% off select favorites during their cyber sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code YUM at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. Go to omahasteaks.com to get 50% off site-wide plus an extra 20% off select favorites and more limited-time deals during their cyber sale. And use promo code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details. A big thanks to our advertiser, Omaha Steaks.
When we come up with a belief about money when we're a child and we don't talk about money, that belief stays put. And then we'll end up stuck with a belief that it can be very limiting. I'm going to check the balance on my checking account every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you know, and do that for 2 or 3 weeks. And as you're doing that, one of the like kind of revolutionary about that is that by checking it more often, that already affects the choices that you make just by checking in, just by looking and seeing where things are. And then that kind of, you start feeling the power.
Everyone, if you're looking to be inspired, motivated, educated, and entertained, you have come to the right place. Welcome to the Bomb Mom Podcast, the podcast where we explore your fitness, life mindsets, and actions to help you become unstoppable. You're worth it, and it's time to finally make changes in your life that will last you the rest of your life. Welcome to the Bomb Mom Podcast, everyone. I am Melissa Vogel, your host. I am so excited that you are here, that you have found this podcast, or you're returning to this podcast. Today is a little bit different, and I love that. I love just exploring all different topics with you guys because it's all connected to living a better life and helping your kids to live their best life ever as well. Today, we're diving into finances and we make comparisons to fitness and stuff, but really conversations that need to be had, understanding how it all works. And you are going to want to get the most amazing book that we talk about on today's show. But first, I'm so glad that you guys are returning or that you're here as a brand new listener. This podcast is just all about making your life better. One choice, one step, one day at a time. And one of the questions that I asked our amazing guest today was, you know, what's one step we can take? What's one thing that we can do? It was so simple. Her response is just so simple. And I share this, and I'm not telling you exactly what we talked about. We'll get into that. But I share this because I get asked this question a lot of like, I don't even know where to start, Melissa. Like, what can I do? Like, what should I do just to get started? I cannot tell you guys and stress enough how important just walking every single day is. There are so many benefits to walking. It's like ridiculous. So many benefits. But on top of that, it's showing you and teaching you how to be consistent. And consistency is key. And I don't care how big or small that is, consistency is key. So when you teach and train yourself to just go for a walk every single day, rain, snow, shine, whatever, I'm going to do this no matter what for 20 minutes every single day, it will literally rock your world. It will change you. It's insane. I started doing this with my kids when they were little and I was trying to get out of the house and just be active and move. And that's how I really learned how important this was because I was like, God, I don't feel like doing it today or the baby's upset or I don't want to do this, whatever. And I would repeat to myself, no, you made a promise. get your stuff together, get your shit together, and go figure it out and get moving. And the more I thought about this, I was like, oh my God, I taught myself so many important and valuable lessons back then. Because guess what? Even though now, today, my big workout isn't going for a walk for 20 minutes or 3 miles or whatever it may be, now it's, you need to get your butt up and you need to go do your third leg workout for the week. My fitness has changed and improved so much over just the last 6 years. I'm sitting here going, wow, I would never be able to show up for myself and to the gym like I do now had I not started somewhere and just taught myself the importance of showing up for me and teaching myself to learn how to value myself. Like, it's huge. And I have this whole YouTube video. We turned that into a podcast. You guys, you have to go back and listen to that episode. It's 2 episodes back. It was so good. We made it into a YouTube. We made it into a podcast. It's all about the truth and valuing yourself, which then leads to amazing results and a booty and six pack. I wish I was kidding. I'm not. That's literally how it works. Everyone always wants to know, what's the secret? That's part of the secret. I'm telling you right now. And today we're talking all about finances, and fitness and finance go hand in hand. And we're talking about just basic, simple steps that you can take to get your finances in order, to just start learning and to just start having conversations with your kids. I didn't even think of these simple things. So MLA Guy Birkin, our guest today, has brought so much light to the surface on this topic. And I'm so glad that she came on the show and then we get to talk about something a little bit different, yet still talking about fitness and finances. Emily is a former educator. She was a teacher, actually an English teacher, and she's been a lifelong money nerd. And she is also award-winning freelance writing, specializing in scientific research behind irrational money behaviors. We talk about this in the podcast today, and I was like, oh my God, I've never heard of behavioral economics, and we dive into it. I love how she lays everything out for us. But she is the author of 5 books, including The 5 Years Before You Retire and Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. And she wrote that with Joe Saul Shea. I hope I'm not destroying his name, but it's an amazing book. And I asked her, what is the number one book that our listeners need to just start with? You know, which one? It is Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. This is something you are all going to want to get. And we talk about how she adds humor to it and how it starts off as basic and helping you guys learn. So as always, please rate and review this podcast. Leave me a review. I want to start reading them off on the podcast. 5 stars. Please, greatly appreciate it. Check out the show notes because I want you guys to consider becoming a Bomb Mom. If you are a mom looking to really get in shape, there's links in there to get connected with me. There will be links in there so you can get some Bomb Mom swag. We do sales all the time. And there's also going to be links in there to join our challenge that is starting this month. It is not too late. And get in there, baby steps. Why not, right? We're all talking about just taking the first step with our finances and learning about money and helping our kids. Why not take the first step with your fitness as well? So enjoy the show. Check the show notes. We'll have the link to her amazing book. And I can't wait to hear what you guys think of all of this. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Bomb Mom Podcast. Today we get to talk all about money with our freelance writer, author, and finance expert, Emily Guy Birkin. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, there are so many similarities between fitness and finance.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Like the security, the planning, the consistency, like mm-hmm. everything. So I can't wait to dive into this more. We have talked about finances on the podcast once before, but it's been so long and the world is so different
now. Oh, yeah.
Like it's completely different. Mm-hmm. So when I was approached to have you on, I was like, yes, we are totally bringing Emily on. So you have worn some serious hats in your lifetime. I mean, we're talking, you used to be a teacher, a temporary tattoo artist. You're an author. Like, how did you get down into finances now? Mm-hmm. How did this become your path?
I tripped and fell backwards into this career. I'm actually an English teacher by training, high school English for 4 years. And because I have a gift of just impeccable timing, my husband and I moved after my fourth year of teaching, and our first child was due at the beginning of the following school year. So that meant, you know, even though they, no one could legally say, no, we're not going to hire you, no one was going to hire me because I was have to take maternity leave at the very beginning of the school year. So the original plan was I was going to take a year off to stay home with the baby. And then that changed for a couple of reasons. One, we just impeccable timing again, we're not able to sell our old house because we put it on the market right after the first time home buyer credit ended. So like just perfect timing.
Yeah.
So we were carrying two mortgages. And so we'd gone from two people in the family to three, two incomes to one, and one mortgage to two. And so it was like, okay, I can't stay home and not be bringing something in. So I decided to start looking for some freelance writing gigs because I've always been a writer. That is one, you know, through line that's in every part of my life. Oddly enough, one of the first freelance jobs that I landed was for a financial website. And now that might sound like, okay, wait, what? English teacher, financial website, why did you do this? Uh-huh. Well, my father was a financial planner. So I did grow up in that industry. And I was a lifelong money nerd. Like I have always spent a lot of time kind of like navel gazing about money, but how I handle money, about, you know, think about ways to make sure that my money works for me and things like that. So I was like, I'll give it a try with this website. So one of the first articles that I wrote for that website went mini viral. So, you know, this was 2010. So it wasn't like, ginormous viral, but went mini viral. You know, it did really well for that site. So the editor was really pleased, gave me more work, passed my name along to his friends who are also in the financial blogging community, and then invited me to a financial media conference that was coming up. It did not occur to me that I would be writing about money, but it turned out that I had really been prepared for it well by being a teacher, because teaching is all about making things relatable to people who don't necessarily want to be there. Finding ways to connect things, make it clear that this is important to people who are, you know, reluctant for whatever reason. And then because of my background in literature and writing and all of that, I'm coming at it from a very different place than a lot of financial writers who come from the finance world. And so they go very straightforward. They tend to be very, you know, like just the facts, just the numbers. And because of my background with literature and with writing, I try to tell stories and try to draw people in a way where the communication is going to be really helpful, where just straight numbers are not.
That's awesome. And yeah, no one wants to learn English when they're in school and hear that. So yeah, you're right. That whole background 100% helped you be able to relate to everyone else. So now what? Where are you at now with this? How did writing turn into a career?
So yeah, it was really kind of amazing. I'm now the author of 5 books. 4 books I've written by myself, and then the 5th one that just came out, Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management, which I wrote with my friend Josal Sehi, who's a podcaster. So part of what happened when I went to that first financial media conference, I just happened to be chatting with someone who was there who had a website, and he and I got along really well. We had similar senses of humor. We enjoyed chatting with each other, and he asked if I'd write a daily column for his website. So I started writing that daily column. And about a year and a half later, my first publisher came up with the idea for a book in-house and then went looking for a writer. That's a relatively common method for books to come about from certain types of publishing houses. So the book was called The 5 Years Before You Retire. My editor was familiar with my column. And so he thought that I'd be a good fit for that writing project. And so he reached out to me and said, "Are you interested in this?" And I said, "Yes, I am very interested in this. I've always dreamed of writing a book." And so I ended up writing The 5 Years Before You Retire in 2013. It came out in January 2014 and became an Amazon bestseller pretty quickly and has remained kind of a perennial good seller. I just put out a revised and updated version in May of 2021.
And then after that, that publisher has asked me to write more books. I wrote Choose Your Retirement and then followed it up with Making Social Security Work for You. And then I wrote My Labor of Love and Financial Stress Now, which was a book that I had been thinking about writing for quite a long time and had been really interested in. And then in part because of that, my friend Joe, who's a podcaster, he had been wanting to write a book and realized that he really wanted to collaborate, that writing it solo was going to be more difficult. And so he's like, who's someone I know who is a great writer, who knows how to, you know, format a book, get it all tidied up and all of that, and who has the same kind of sense of humor that I do. And he claims I was the first one on his list. So I like to joke. It's just like, it's only because Salman Rushdie was busy. I was second choice. Yeah.
So where are you gaining all of this knowledge to write these books? Because this is impressive. Four alone, five with him. Like, I have to say, I love the title, The 5 Years Before You Retire and Stack. Like, that's, I like it. I really like, because it makes you think like, oh my God, am I 5 years out? No, wait, I'm still 10. No, I'm 20. No, my God. No, some people are listening. They're like, I'm 3 years out. Yeah. You know, so where's all this from for you?
So some of this comes from the things that I have just been interested in my whole life. Like, I have been interested in finance. I've been interested in particularly the psychology of finance. So long before I ever heard the term behavioral economics, which is a relatively new field, you know, traditional economics thinks that everyone acts rationally and that, you know, you give someone choices, they're going to choose whatever has the best utility to them. And I don't know how economics as a field was able to go for hundreds of years believing that. When faced with the real world and nobody acting that way. So in the past about 40 to 50 years, behavioral economics has kind of combined psychology with economics and looked at why we make the weird choices that we do that cause us to have suboptimal financial decisions. When, you know, in a vacuum, we could say like, yeah, no, that's not going to be the right choice. But when we add in our psychology, our sense of ethics, our morals, our emotions, all of those things, that leads us astray and we make disordered money choices. So some of where this knowledge comes from is I've just been fascinated by that from forever. I got into behavioral economics through sociology. I was reading a whole bunch of sociology books that are, you know, they're for everyone. They're not for, you know, people who are studying it in the ivory tower. And that kind of led me through to finding behavioral economics. Dan Ariely in particular, he wrote Predictably Irrational. And that's just a phenomenal book that helps you understand why you make the choices you do. And it's not just money. I mean, fitness is another thing. Like, why is it that you do everything? Like, I set out my clothes, I set the alarm, I put a glass of water beside my bed, I put my shoes right there, and I wake up and I go, I'm not going for a run. Why do we do that when we do really want to go for a run, but we don't? And so we don't. And so that's something that I think is just really fascinating. And then when it comes to the details of stuff having to do with retirement, with Social Security, I, you know, bring my training and research to that. And it's also something that I find really just satisfying, doing research into these very arcane situation and options that most people are going to be like, no, shut it down. I can't. Yeah. It's too much to read.
And I love that you want to do it and dive in and then you take it and then you deliver it to us. So we're like, just tell us what we need to know. You do the work, you write a book on it, and then we'll read it. Great. Thanks.
Yeah. I get to have some fun with it in ways because I like the connections that come up in my head as I'm reading through these things. So, you know, for instance, when I was writing my book on Social Security is a lot easier to understand if you use examples because it's just too amorphous. If you're talking about things without saying like, this is what would happen for this person if she were 66 and blah, blah, blah. So partially to just, you know, entertain myself, every example, I used names of characters from some of my favorite books. And so I'm waiting for an English teacher who's retiring to be looking through like, hey, that's from...
Wait a minute.
I also used names that were in some way appropriate or inappropriate. So for people who are disabled, I used names from the book Watchmen by Alan Moore, because that's about people who act as superheroes. And I was like, they're most likely to be disabled. Because
they're going to, you know, try a backflip and it's just going to land wrong. And then they're going to have to be on Social Security disability.
Right. No, I love this. And I can't stress enough, you guys, to get her books, read them, educate yourself, like acquire the knowledge yourself, because it's going to help you in every aspect of your life. You know, and I love that you're bringing up the psychology, and that's like how it got you into it, because you were like interested in it and stuff. And I've never heard of behavioral economics before. Like, that's eye-catching. But tell us more about these terrible, awful, bad decisions that we make around money when we know it's not a good choice, yet we do it anyway. I would love to know more about what you think of that and what you're finding in your research over the years and stuff.
Yeah. So one of the things that's really hard to wrap our heads around with money is the fact that it doesn't actually exist. And I know your listeners are going like, what are you talking about? It exists. I've got a 20 in my pocket right now. So money doesn't occur in nature. You can't eat money. You can't build a house out of money. You can't wear money, and you can't even spend it outside of places where it is not legal tender. So what money is a delusion that we all share. We have all collectively decided that these little pieces of paper and these numbers on a screen have value. And it's important. We need to have that, because otherwise, like, there's no way to make society work. So, you know,
yeah, there'd be like no order.
Yeah. It's a construct that we created to fill a real need. Now, the problem is, because it doesn't actually exist, we are going to put our own emotional viewpoints on it. So you cannot say like money is this and be absolutely correct, because it's different for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so if you are someone who grew up in a home that had instability when it came to money, your view of money is going to be very different from someone who grew up with a great deal of privilege and had money to be able to spend on any kind of, you know, enormous thing that they wanted. And neither of you are wrong about what money is. It's a snapshot of what money is, rather than the truth of what it can do for you and how it can work. And so a lot of times what will happen is we will make money decisions emotionally rather than financially. So something that you might see is someone who loses their job, they might counterintuitively, even though they just lost their job, they don't know when their next paycheck is coming because they got to start looking for a new job, they'll go and spend $300 online or whatever to make themselves feel better. What they're doing, and one of the things I make sure I want to say is, like, there's no such thing as a bad money decision. There's disordered money decisions, because that decision to spend that money, you're not doing that because you're bad with money or not smart or anything. You're doing that because you have an emotional need. You need to feel better. And you know that retail therapy always gives you a bit of a boost. And so that is perfectly reasonable and rational. And if you don't take the time to examine what am I doing and why am I doing it, you are not going to be able to say like, oh, wait, this is actually going to cause me more stress. So what's another way I can get a boost? Can I call my sister and we can go, you know, go get margaritas? Can I, you know, go for a run? And because that gives me a boost and I won't feel the need for, you know, a $300 shopping spree. All those different things. Once you are aware that you're meeting an emotional need with money, you can start saying like, what's a better way to meet that emotional need?
I love that you're bringing this up, because this is the same thing with like food and people who get addicted to food and the sugar. And yes, food addiction is a real thing and addicted to sugar and all that. But at the same time, I'm like, is it that, or is it the emotional need that you need fulfilled at that very moment? Mm-hmm. You know, someone who goes off and binges or has had a long day and then they turn to, you know, the snacks and they're like, oh, well, I didn't eat much and I'm just, you know, doing whatever. Well, did you have a really stressful day? What led you to that point of binging? And it's the exact same thing. Isn't it crazy how we use all of these things to fulfill our emotional needs?
Oh yeah.
Money, food. And all we have to do is just stop. And like you said, figure out the what and the why and come up with better choices. But I think this is making a lot of light bulbs go off for people of like, oh my God, I didn't even realize I was doing this with my money and finances.
Those are the sorts of things that people are kind of more aware of. So, you know, the person who goes for a shopping spree when they're feeling down, even if it's, you know, they're in a bad financial situation, they are able to look back and say like, those are not good decisions. Then there's the kind of the absence of decisions that happen as well, where
people will be intimidated by the idea of dealing with finances. And so they make no decision. They have analysis paralysis type thing. And that can be even more damaging in some ways, because you lose out oftentimes with financial decisions when it comes to things like investing, setting money aside for retirement. Making no decision is objectively the worst possible decision. But because there is so much out there and you feel like you have to know what you're doing before you start, you're just like, all right, it's too complicated. I need to decide on this later. And so you put it aside and you never get to it. And I think, I'm sure that there are similar things with like, okay, I know I want to get in shape. I don't know what's going to be the best for me. I don't have time to look into, you know, classes near me, what gyms there are. And so I'll do it later. I'll do it later. And then later never comes. And again, it's the objectively the worst decision. Whereas like, you would be better to just be like, I don't know what to do. So I'm going to go for a walk. Objectively better than finding the optimal choice.
We hear it a lot right now with the keto diet, the low fat, the high fat, the no carb, the intermittent fasting. There's so many things. And then people are like, I don't know what to do. So I just don't do anything anymore.
Yeah.
Hey, so I thought this would be a good time to give you guys a little bit more information on my online program, Busy to Bomb Fit Mom. If you are looking to be motivated, inspired, finally get off your butt and do the things that you want to do with your health and your fitness and your workout and your body and hit those goals, we need to talk. Busy to Bomb Fit Mom is a full online program. It's a 90-day program that's going to get you into the best shape of your life. Now, is it an easy diet plan to follow or all these amazing workouts that I'm just going to hand you on a silver platter? No. This program is going to love and support you. It's going to motivate you, get you heading in the right direction. But you don't have to do it alone. You're going to have an entire support system with you. You're going to have me as your coach, coaching you on nutrition, your workouts. I become your virtual personal trainer. So if this is something that you're looking for and you just need that extra push and someone on your heels telling you that you're worth it and it's time, we need to talk. Visit www.busytobombfitmom.com. Book a call with me. Let's see if this is a fit for you. All right, back to the show.
What's the best way to start learning so they feel comfortable and saying, okay, I know nothing about money. I know nothing about Social Security or like what I'm supposed to be doing in retirement. What's the best like first step of like, just do this?
Well, first thing is forgive yourself. So, because a lot of that sense of like, oh my God, I can't do it. I don't know. Is the sense like I should know better. And it's just like, no, you're where you are. And that's totally fine. And it's also just start with something that you know you should be doing. So, you know, before you get into like, oh my goodness, I got to, you know, put money in my 401k. Oh my goodness, I got to figure out, you know, what my asset allocation is. Before you do that, what's something that you're not doing that you know you should be doing? So that could be like, you should be checking on your balance in your checking account more often. Start there. Say like, you know what? I'm going to start with, I'm going to check the balance on my checking account every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you know, and do that for 2 or 3 weeks. And as you're doing that, one of the like kind of revolutionary about that is that by checking it more often, you are going to be like, oh goodness, there's that coming up. Or, you know, oh, if I buy something, I'll overdraw my account because it's the day before payday or, you know, something like that. And so that already affects the choices that you make just by checking in, just by looking and seeing where things are. And then that kind of, you start feeling the power and then you feel more capable and more competent about like, okay, now what can I do to continue to improve things? Whereas if you go into like, all right, I got to do everything perfectly and maximize it all, it's going to be overwhelming and you'll shut down. So just start very, very small with a little promise to yourself.
Yeah, I love that because not enough people do that right now. Mm-hmm. They're just blind. They're like, I don't know, you know, especially like the younger generations. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm hearing that a lot of people in their like 20s and 30s that they're just like, I don't know, you know, I'm not too worried about it. And I'm like, oh, maybe you should be, maybe you should be paying a little bit more attention to it. You know, especially, let's talk about women. I want to dive into women because we do have a majority of women listening to this podcast. You know, women are really held back when it comes to financial success. You know, what do you think holds most females back from achieving that and like going for it or making massive monies and becoming these empowered entrepreneurs?
So there's a couple of things going on. One is kind of like the historical fact and continuing fact that women are often shut out of financial conversations. That is something that you internalize. If, you know, you get a lifetime of like little messages saying like, this is not for you, you internalize it and go like, okay, this isn't for me. And then even if you don't get those messages, when you step into a financial situation, you're often going to be surrounded by men who are not necessarily going to make you feel welcome. I have personally experienced that. I cannot tell you the number of times I've had my own books mansplained to me. It's something that we are very susceptible to, imposter syndrome as women. We are very susceptible to this sense like, oh, well, maybe I don't know. Maybe I need to do a little more research. So now that's really, really tough for women, but it's also kind of a superpower because studies have shown consistently that women are better investors than men over and over and over again. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that men are more likely to invest emotionally, which is funny considering the stereotypes about men and women.
Interesting. Yeah. I did not know that. I would never have thought that.
Yeah. So men are more likely to chase turns when things are going well. So, I mean, if you notice, like all the people who are talking about cryptocurrency and NFTs are for the most part men. And some of that is like, oh, wow, it's going really, really well. I want in on that. There's also kind of the bandwagon effect. Men are more likely to be like, oh, a lot of people are doing this. I want to do this.
Yeah.
And so women, and it's not that women aren't susceptible to those emotions, but because we are kind of living with that imposter syndrome, we come into investing with the sense like we need to make sure that we are researching things before we start. We don't just jump in. So that's a good thing and a bad thing. But when we do invest, women are more likely to come up with an investment plan where they decide, okay, this is what I am planning to do. This is the amount of money I'm planning to put into investments. These are the types of investments I'm comfortable doing, putting my money in. And this is what I'll do if there is a market drop or if things go really well. So women actually put that goal in writing and they put it in place so that they know like when, you know, one of their investments is going gangbusters and part of them's thinking like, oh, maybe I should put another, you know, $10,000 in that, even though that would be, you know, everything I have to invest. They've got, oh, I've got the plan. And the plan says this should only be a certain percentage of my investing. And so that means they're not going to lose all of that if it goes bust later. Mm-hmm. Same thing where if things are going really badly and the market tanks, women are more likely to stay the course because they're saying, I am investing for the long term. It's okay that it took a downturn because it's going to go back up again because the stock market goes up over time. So since I don't need the money right now, this is nothing I need to worry about. Whereas men are much more likely to just jump when they have this kind of stimulus. And so that's one of those things where it's a blessing and a curse that because women have traditionally been shut out, we are more cautious in a way that makes us much better investors.
Yeah, I love that because it's a superpower, but you're so right about, you know, even just growing up and what we say to our kids and stuff and what they hear about money, especially little girls. Mm-hmm. And like, it's not really a conversation people are having with their children, probably more girls as well, you know, and I just bought my first home this year.
Congratulations.
And thank you. And it was interesting because people kept asking for my husband, or if I was the only one making this decision. Or then when I got in the home, people were like, are you the homeowner? Why? Yes, I am. Does anyone else need to be present? No, they do not. And just so many times, I wish I would have written down how many people had questioned like, oh, you're the owner. Oh, you're the only one on, you know, your mortgage. Mm-hmm. You just get me. And my daughter at one point, my oldest was like, why do people keep asking you that? And I'm like, because they think I'm married or I should be married or there should be a man sitting down and signing all these papers. So I think it's very interesting. Can we talk about kids really quick too?
Sure.
Because while we're kind of like talking about this, what they witness, I don't think people have the slightest clue of how to teach their kids about money and how to be financially responsible with it, yet have sense of like fun
you know, and not like never spend because, you know, you're saving for this for a rainy day. And how do we start having this conversation with our kids so they grow up with healthy thoughts and feelings and emotions about money?
So with money, we tend to try to shield our kids from money issues. And it's because we feel stress ourselves. And that's a, you know, an understandable parental, you know, impulse, you know, to protect and shield your kids from the things that are stressing you out. But our kids are going to pick up on that stress. They're little sponges. They know what's going on. And so what you can do is invite them into the financial tasks that you have in the same way that you're teaching your kids how to cook by saying, sure, you can help me when you're cooking, or how to do laundry by saying, you know, hey, I need you to move the stuff from the washer into the dryer. It is a regular task. You know, dealing with your money is a regular task that you do, and you can invite your kids into this task. I know people listening are like, oh my goodness, I cry every time I deal with my money. I don't want my kids involved in that. And like, that is completely understandable. So start with, what are some things that you can do that you can feel good about bringing your kids in? If you are in a place where you're not feeling stable about money and you don't want to expose them to it. So things like, if you do decide to, you know, like just check in on your checking account 3 times a week. So, you know, in some families, people don't talk about money. They don't want to talk about how much they have, how much they make, anything like that. But, you know, even just letting your kids know, like, I check on our money 3 times a week, that's a start. And so let them ask questions and answer them honestly. From there, you can start bringing them into financial conversations. And they don't have to be the big ones. They can be little things like, when you're at the grocery store, point out how you can see how much things are the per unit cost versus the actual cost. Can you help me find what is the least expensive oatmeal? Can you help me figure out if we're getting the best of this kind? And so that actually, with little kids, that can end up being like a fun game, you know, like, oh yeah, let's try to, you know, figure out how to save money on this. So that's, you may even be able to say like, okay, I'm planning on spending this amount at the grocery store. If you're able to save $5, you could pick out, you know, something in the checkout line or something like that, that's $5 or less. So those are the sorts of things that you can do. And then that kind of builds upon itself and grows from there, in the same way that, you know, having your toddler, you know, help when you make breakfast, you know, they're basically throwing the egg in the bowl without cracking it, eventually morphs to, you know, they're making their own breakfasts in the morning, eventually morphs to, you're teaching them your grandmother's roast chicken recipe. Your invitation of bringing them into your finances grows with them. And as they ask questions, and as there are things where you're like, I don't know how to teach this, start with like learning it yourself, because the best way to learn is to teach someone else.
That's so true.
And so if you're like, I want to make sure my kids understand how credit cards work, but I don't really get how it works. I don't get what my credit score is. So like, okay, I'm going to like spend an hour looking at it. And then I'm going to bring my kid in and say like, okay, I want to help you learn this. I don't completely understand it. So let's do this together. This is the basics that I was able to glean, you know, those sorts of things.
Oh, Emily, I love that you're just like talking about, just talk about it. But parents are so afraid they're going to like screw it up. And I can make a huge comparison with like fitness and food. And I've had so many women tell me that like, I don't want to talk about ingredients or things like that, or working out or exercise, because I don't want to make them self-conscious or think that like, I'm telling them that to exercise because they're fat. And I think they're fat, and, you know, and then now they're self-conscious about it or whatever. And I'm like, kids are going to develop their own thoughts and opinions about things no matter what. You know, whether it's about working out or money, you know, and it's our job to guide them in a healthy way to have healthy relationships with both. Honestly, I don't think I ever would have thought of having just open conversations about fitness with my kids. I love that you said about the unit thing, because I do that with my oldest in Costco. And I was showing her like, well, we could get this laundry detergent, but this is just like it, but look at how much it cost. You know, and she's like, oh, and so I'm trying to get her to think of that more. And she now has a debit card and a savings account and how to transfer and stuff. But, you know, I didn't think of like, okay, these are finance conversations that need to happen even younger before her.
Yeah. It's the sort of thing where like, we build our own ideas of what the world is like when we're kids. And so for a lot of those ideas, like if you get a weird idea in your head, it is dispelled because people talk about it. So the example I always give, my mother likes to tell about how when she was a little girl, she truly believed that doctors weren't allowed to get sick or else they'd have to go to jail. I'm not sure where that came from, but that was a belief that she held.
Yeah.
And because it made sense to, you know, a little girl. But because we talk about doctors, we talk about illness, and we talk about jail, she learned that she was wrong. When we come up with a belief about money when we're a child and we don't talk about money, that belief stays put. And so we don't have anything to challenge that belief. And then we'll end up stuck with a belief that it can be very limiting. So someone who grew up with not much money and who was like, I'm never going to feel that way again. And so like bank balances should always go up, never go down. That was a belief that they created in childhood, that that's a way that they'd feel secure. But the thing is, that's very limiting because if you feel that way, then you don't feel comfortable ever using your money. And so if you have an emergency and you need to, you know, have money go down in your emergency fund, that's going to cause you a great deal of stress. When money is a tool and, you know, you put it there for a reason, we're earning it for a reason. You want to be able to use it. And so that's one of the things, and I see a lot of parallels with fitness and food. You know, I have limiting beliefs about food because of what was said to me about food and what I observed about food when I was growing up. And so I think one thing that's really helpful to remind people, to remind parents, is that limiting beliefs don't come about because you talk openly. They come about because you keep things secret. And so, you know, like kids growing up believing that, you know, some food is bad and they should never eat it. Now, that could come from someone saying like food is bad and you should never eat it, or, you know, ice cream is bad and you should never eat it. But it also comes from, you know, seeing people make these decisions and not understanding where they come from. So that's something that I think is really, really helpful. And, you know, it's never going to be perfect. So I'll give an example. I have been doing finance since my eldest was 3 months old. So I've been in the finance world for over 11 years. And my second child, my 8-year-old, very recently was reading a book that one of my colleagues had written for children. It was the ABCs of money, and E was for electricity. And I don't remember exactly. It was talking about like turn lights off so you can save money on electricity. And he's like, electricity costs money? And I was like, how have I never covered this before? It never occurred to me that I hadn't mentioned that. And, you know, it's understandable why that would not occur to him, that that's something that we have to pay for, because it just is. We are very lucky to be in a position where, you know, he's never experienced an outage that wasn't, you know, widespread. We've never been in a position where we were worried about the electricity being shut off. And so it didn't occur to him that that's something that people pay for.
I've had the same conversation not that long ago with my daughter and like the water. And I was telling her, like, every time that runs, I think I told my daughter the other day, because I have all girls and, you know, when you get older, you have more hair and it's all thick and curly, and that takes time to wash and rinse out. And then now they're shaving their legs and that takes more time. And I was explaining to her, she's like, but don't worry, I shut it off because I remember what you said. And I was like, think of a gallon, you know, a jug of milk, you know, and if you just have that water pouring out, how quickly would you fill that? She's like, yeah. And I'm like, that costs money. Like every gallon, you know, is water. And I'm like, I don't want you to think that we can't afford money and come from a place of like scarcity, because that's a whole nother topic. But I said, you need to be aware of it and know that like, we don't just turn on our faucets in this home, in this community for free. In Michigan, if you lived on a well, you didn't pay for the water. You know, so that's totally different. But yeah, basic conversations, lights on, lights off, money, electricity, it costs.
Yeah, that's just, you know, helping your kids understand how the world works. And because they'll figure out how the world works, but it might be kind of mistaken if you don't talk to them about it.
Absolutely. Okay. If we had to pick one of the books to get right away of yours, which one would it be? You're like, you definitely read this one first.
So my most recent book with Joe Salcihi is Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. So I recommend this. I mean, all of my books are great, but I recommend this because Joe and I specifically set out to create a complete guide to finance from, you know, starting from the very beginning to like advanced graduate level finance, and throughout using humor. So we wanted this to be a book that people who don't read finance books would want to read. So we had a wonderful time making jokes. That's one of the things that I really was drawn to about this project, because I love adding humor to anything that I write. It often gets edited out in a lot of my stuff because, you know, a lot of my editors, they just kind of want straightforward. And so this gave me a chance to be like, let that humor off the leash. So there's ridiculous fart jokes. I mean, there's the silly stuff. And then, but we always take finances seriously, and we set it up because in a way that we know, even if you're starting with chapter one going like, I don't know anything, you will get to the final chapter and say like, oh, I know how to do this. And I feel really comfortable with things like the efficient frontier and the really more intensive financial stuff. That's what I would recommend. I think it's a lot of fun to read, even if you're someone who's like, I would never pick up a financial book.
No, I love that. And I feel like I can just take a deep breath now and breathe. And hopefully other people listening to this too can just be like, okay, it's not like this hard money book, and it's got humor and I can read, and it's going to gradually get more serious and intense. Like, but you're ready for it, and there's humor throughout. Like, that gives me a sigh of relief to, okay, get the freaking book, read it, pass it on. And we're going to put links to it all in the show notes too. So if you guys are like trying to scramble, what was the name of that again and stuff? We will put it in the show notes, so everything is there. But Emily, I feel like we could just go on and on about finances and mindset, but this has been amazing and very enlightening.
Thank you.
As well, I'm so glad you got to be on, but we'll put everything in the show notes. Where can people find you on social media? What's your website?
So my website is emilyguyburkin.com. You might be able to see me on a 40 city book tour. Joe and I are on tour in April, May, and June.
Oh, cool.
Promote the book. I am only going on about, I think, 12 or 14 of the cities. Joe's doing the whole thing because wow. And so you can find out where we'll be if you go to emilyguyburkin.com/stacked. And so that gives you the tour information. And even if I'm not there, you can go say hi to Joe. You can also find me on Twitter. I am on Twitter way more than I should be. My handle is at Emily Guy Burkin, but I love connecting with readers there. So, you know, please come say howdy. And then I also do something on Twitter every night. I post one good thing from that day. And so that's something I really like to share as well.
Oh, I love that.
You can also find me on Facebook, author Emily Guy Burkin.
Awesome. Oh my God, Emily, this was great. I cannot wait for people to get the book. Maybe when this comes out, we could go live together.
That would be great.
On Facebook. Yeah, I would love doing that when the podcasts come out and go live and everything. And then we go live and promote it that week and just dive in more, answer questions. And
that would
and
be wonderful. I'd love that.
Okay. Oh, well, have fun on your book tour. That will be coming up around the corner. And thanks again for coming and sharing, because this is just a topic that it needs to be brought to the surface. People need to have real conversations with each other, with their spouse and their kids. Thank you for an enlightening on all of it for us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Bye, everyone. Stay safe and stay healthy.
If you are ready to become a bomb mom, join my free course over at www.melissavogelfitness.com/course. This podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regards to the subject matter covered. This is given with the understanding that neither the host, practice of the practice, or the guest are providing legal, mental health, nutritional, or other professional information. If you need a professional, you should find one.